Welcome to Mental Toughness with Dr. Rob Bell. Each week, Dr. Rob sits down with athletes, executives, and expert coaches to talk about mental toughness and their hinge moment. Here's your host, Dr. Rob.
We are the most prominent, most consistent voice in our head. And if we are not positive, we cannot do positive things. So we have to be intentional about loving ourselves just like we do anybody else. And if we're not going to be successful.
So our guest today is CEO and founder, along with his wife, Kariana, who started Playbook Clinics, which is created by football coaches to meet the challenges of today's game. Our guest is also a linebackers coach at Bishop Blanchet in Seattle. He's coached the Seattle Majestics. He's an entrepreneur, visionary, lot of different careers. And excited about this conversation today with coach, I always call him coach, DJ Wilson. DJ, man, thank you so much for taking the time and joining us today.
You bet, Rob. I'm honored to be here and appreciate all you're doing to support coaches and people in general.
I've always researched the individuals that I'm getting ready to interview, and your life, which I want to talk all about, took a lot of different turns. But what I noticed was you spent many years early on in politics. Like, this is always slow pitch softball question, but did you have a dream of pursuing politics?
Oh yeah, man. From the earliest days, so I'm 48, so I'm a Cold War baby. And, I remember very clearly things like the presidential debates in 1980 and the Reykjavik summit in 1985, and the threat of maybe going to Nicaragua, in 1983, and some of those kind of really palpable moments in the 80s. And so I felt this kind of protector kind of urge. And I thought that at the time and for the early part of my life, I thought that the best way to help keep level heads to support and protect our community was to get involved in politics. And I still think that's a noble profession. And I run for office and won, but mostly lost, and worked behind the scenes to support folks that I appreciated and liked. And that took the shape of working on both sides of the aisle. I worked for a Republican senator, U.S. senator, a couple of Democratic elected officials, U.S. senator, a member of Congress. They say that people who are in the middle of the road get run over, and we call them roadkill. You're either on it's more successful to be on the far left or the far right these days. And that was never really my home. So it was a fun time.
So you founded 8 different companies. And I'm always fascinated, obviously, by the successes. You had 2 successful exits. You talked about 2 being mediocre, but then you had 2 epic failures. And I'm a firm believer. I know we learn way more from our failures. And let me just preface this by, I failed as well. And I know that it takes like part of your soul kind of out of you, at least for a little bit. I mean, you have to kind of search because your identity is so wrapped up in it. Can you talk to us about, you know, those failures and coming out of those and what you learned about yourself during those?
Yeah, I think our failures make us who we are. There's this great, great book that's just been out by Rick Rubin called The Creative Act, A Way of Life. And I just finished it. One of the things he says in there is that failure is the information you need to get to where you're going. And, you really don't learn that much from success because you feel like you must be the smartest guy in the room. It's really just the failures that force you to be self-reflective. And part of what I've taken from my failures over the year is, just a reflection that if you are in baseball and you get a hit 1 out of 3 times, you're going to the Hall of Fame. You know, like if you strike out 2 out of 3 times, but you get a hit 1 out of 3 times, you're going to the Hall of Fame. So we got to take our cuts and we got to, you know, be ready to accept setbacks. So we talk about in our companies and our culture that we want to be 80% 80% of the time. And if we can be 80% effective 80% of the time, we're going to be very, very good. And that the whole notion, this is particularly important, I think, for smart, high-achieving people, particularly early in their career, because smart, high-achieving people think they need to be 100%. Like, that's how they're trained in college. That's, you know, they got to get straight A's 4.0. And that is not how life works. And so we try to take young people, particularly early career or even sometimes mid-career professionals, and say, hey, look, man, you can put yourself on a pathway for 100% success. It means you will never stretch. You will never try. You will never do anything hard. You will only take the easy path. And your life is so much, should be so much more than that. And so, you know, our failures in business, my failures in business have just reminded me that, boy, I've got to stretch. I'm more alive when I stretch. And if I get one hit at three at-bats, I'm going to be just fine.
Hey, good looking. If you like this podcast and are already a badass, but it's all way too complicated, then visit our website, drrobbell.com, and schedule a call with us to help capture your very own hinge moment.
Oh, I love that, man. I think you named the podcast episode there too, DJ. That's going to be awesome, man. 80% of the time.
Love I think that. That's so important, man. If you could do B work 4 days out of five, you're going to be so much farther ahead of everybody, not just your competition, but who you can be. And as you know, like, most of success in the world, sports otherwise, is just avoiding unforced errors.
Right.
If you can just avoid self-harm, you are ahead of the game.
Yep.
So
the team that makes the fewest mistakes usually wins.
100%.
I'm a general Neyland Maxim guy. I went to the University of Tennessee. So, I mean, that's Maxim number one. The team that makes the fewest mistakes usually wins.
True. But I will say, sorry, Rob, just to add one final thing on that.
Go, man. You run.
We are evolutionarily hardwired going back millions of years, but also in all recent modern history, to overestimate the risk of anything we're facing. We are hardwired to take care and to not take action unless we think it's safe. And I think this actually fits within the construct of your recent book, which is, like, I think being patient is, like, it's graduate level. It's like next level stuff, right? Because our first inclination is to not act. And people will just sit on their hands and say, oh, I'll do it tomorrow, or it's too scary, or the risk of failure is too great. We're hardwired to think that that's the case, and it's not. It's not as scary as we think. And then so this idea of taking action, sometimes it is okay to take action, even if you don't have all the answers. I think that you should be willing to just jump in the thing and go. And once you understand that, like, there's a time and place for action, and you have developed the competency to move and to act, then, like, that's when you get to this sort of sweet spot where you're talking about, in terms of, like, be patient. You don't have to swing at every pitch. Sometimes you just got to wait for the right one.
Mm-hmm. That's why it was such a hard book to write, is because I've always been a ready, fire, aim guy.
Yeah.
And that's how it's always been for me. Like, I when fear would be present, I would go towards it, because, like, I hated the notion of being afraid. And so I'm going to force myself to go for it. And no matter what that was, whether that was talking with somebody, whether that was taking the shot, and Andre Agassi's strength coach told me this a long time ago. He just said, some battles are worth fighting even if you lose. Like, I wanted the shot, knowing that I don't care about missing. Like, I've failed before. It sucks for a while, but most of the story is in our head. But what I saw was there was a huge inability to be patient and wait for the results to happen, you know? So it was, that's why I always felt it was such a hard book to write, because it was a dichotomy of, you know, no one's ever going to say urgency is bad. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying if urgency is the workout, then patience is like the recovery. You've got to have recovery that's in there too, because that's when the muscles grow.
Yeah, and the notion of, I love that you build out this sort of notion of urgent versus the important, because that tension is this a central tension that leaders have to deal with, right? They have to put out the fires, but they can't, they always have to create room for the important. If you stop creating room for the important, you know, you will fail the people who are depending on you, because as a leader, your job is to keep the important in mind, and only deal with the urgent to the extent that your team can't deal with it without you. And that takes, particularly in this world where we have these notifications and we've got all kinds of like, you know, cortisol and oxytocin, all these things floating around, and we're building these kind of neural pathways related to our phones and email and all that stuff. You have to be able to face that down and say, I'm going to let these balls fall, and I'm going to be patient and carve out space to do this thoughtful, important work over here. And I know, you know, that kind of realization happens for different people at different points in their career, but it's super cool that you spent so much time on
Yeah. Well, my wife would disagree. It was
it.
a brutal process writing that stuff, but I
Yeah.
appreciate the notion and the recognition for it.
Yeah.
We're talking about focusing on that, which is important. I mean, Playbook Clinics, have 15 different sites across the country. As an entrepreneur, I mean, the you, here, let me start with this part, and then we'll kind of get into the entrepreneurial logistics part. I mean, the part that
Sure.
really attracted me to Playbook Clinics was the convening panel. So you want to do what the coaches wanted to talk about, what they wanted to address. This is, I mean, just fantastic notion, right? And you spoke about it before. We didn't just go find speakers. We found the topics that coaches wanted to learn more about, and then found speakers that would attach to that. Can you talk about that process?
Yeah, I think there's a lot in there. Part of it is people want to be asked and they've got really good ideas. And the closer to the center of the action that you can get and hear from and listen to, the more raw, the more vulnerable, the more authentic, the more valuable the conversations will be. Part of it is if you want to create good clinics to support coaches, and you want to do it in a place as diverse as Portland, Oregon, and Atlanta, Georgia, those are very different ecosystems. And so you'd be a fool not to ask for help and have guys kind of tell you, like, this is how we do it in Charlotte, or this is how we do it in Kansas City or Orange County. And so our why came from this idea that we have a couple of kind of key stories here, but if you could, let me sort of frame it. Let me give you the whole story, if I can just kind of give you the longer context, because this will put some things into context for you. So in 2020, when COVID hit, my son was, we have three kids, and my son was in 8th grade, and I'd just been a dad. I'd been his like flag football coach and my daughter's soccer coach and basketball and all that stuff. And as we were coming into 2021 and freshman football, he, at that point, a year or so into the pandemic, he was really struggling with his mental health, like a lot of our kids are, like a lot of us, all of us were and continue to be in some cases. And my football experience in high school was toxic and bad. And I did not want to send him into that environment, but I knew that the positive things about football would really help shape him. And so his COVID, coming out of COVID, he could have gone a lot of different directions. And I just wanted to make sure that football experience for him was positive. So I reached out to the head coach and asked if I could hold water on the sidelines. He's like, yeah, sure. Why don't you come help coach the freshman team? And then they said, oh, you don't suck that bad. Why don't you come help us on varsity? And then I coached at the semi-pro level a little bit, just to get some reps in. And what I saw from that was that at our school, we exceeded all of my expectations in terms of culture and support but that it was also clear a lot of other programs, a lot of other head coaches didn't have the tools. They hadn't really been taught how to develop culture, how to support mental health of kids coming out of COVID, how to do things like deal with parents who might have an acute anxiety about how their kids are performing, how to talk about strength and conditioning in a way that leads to injury prevention and not just like what your bench is. So it became clear that the things that I cared about, there needed to be some place where we could support coaches in their development related to mental health, related to culture, related to leadership, and these other things. And at the same time, as a new coach, an older new coach, I needed to go back to school on things like hand placement and footwork and some of the fundamentals. And the clinics that I attended didn't meet my needs. And so they didn't meet my needs on either the fundamentals or this other kind of soft skill stuff. And so as we started talking to head coaches, the head coaches would all uniformly say, yes, we need that soft skill stuff in conversations because nothing can prepare you to be a head coach. Nobody talks about that stuff. Head coaches generally aren't always looking to their assistant coaches to help them think about these things. They don't always get an opportunity to connect with other head coaches, except for this clinic space. And so we thought, boy, coming out of COVID, if there were an opportunity to support head coaches at 16,000 high schools across the country, and they trusted you, and they would turn to you on one weekend out of the year to come and learn from other coaches, what would you tell them? Like, what would you give them in that one weekend? And so we built these convening panels to ask those guys, hey, what do we want to talk about? What do you want to talk about? Who do you know that would be awesome to speak about those issues? And kind of percolated it up. And there was kind of this natural confluence of both our why and our story about why we're getting involved in coaching high school football and what head coaches across country actually said they needed more information about, more support of, which was these softer skills. Everybody knows scheme. Everybody has an opinion on about, you know, what kind of offense they want to run. Even if you have no idea what you're talking about, you still have an opinion about the offense you want to run. But you didn't know maybe about how do I build community around my program? How do I get moms to feel like our program is going to be safe for their young men? How do we get teachers and parents administration in the building to better support our program? How do we fundraise? How do we do strength and conditioning? All of these other things that have nothing to do with scheme. So we want, that's kind of the long story.
You know, yeah, you had the X's and O's, but as you mentioned, that building culture, program development, the mental health, dealing with parents, navigating recruitment, all these aspects to it. As you went around and were facilitating the clinics, what were a couple of the ideas, concepts that really gave you pause and made you think about it in terms of, hey, that is a great strategy. Any in particular to really stand out?
This last weekend, I was in Charlotte helping to host our Charlotte clinic, and sort of two kind of things really stood out to me. Like there was a bunch of stuff there. That was an awesome clinic, soul-filling kind of clinic. And one was this 80-year-old O-line coach, man, Coach McNally. He has spent 47 years coaching in the NFL. He was with us. And at 80 years old, he's climbing up on these tables, showing like how you have to, you know, as you pass protect, you got to pigeon toe your back foot just in a little bit. He's standing up on this table at 80 years old, and guys are there holding his hand, making sure he doesn't fall. And it's just like so awesome to see his passion and the love around him of all those guys in that room. And that was just one breakout room. I just thought like, this is exactly what we're trying to do. We're trying to build a scaffolding where people who have passion and love can come and like help spread that because that becomes infectious. So it was so cool. So Coach Jim McNally, rock star at 80 years old. I wish I could have half his energy when I get that even now. And then this other experience after it was all done and we took everything down. We had broken everything down except for one room. There was about 10 guys still talking. And we had a whiteboard in there, and they were just still whiteboarding together an hour and a half after the clinic was done. And Coach Austin Trotter and a bunch of guys, Coach Tatum and Coach G were in there. And it was just like community, you know, it was like just a safe place where they could talk and build relationship. And it's like it was just a reminder in that second example of kind of the challenge we face, particularly as men, particularly as we get older, in building relationship, in fighting isolation. And so the sort of kind of coolest things for me were not necessarily about X's and O's. It was about, in the case of Coach McNally, passion and love and how that just becomes infectious. And this other piece, like, hey man, community is super important and we don't have as many opportunities as we get older. You know, I'm 48 now, and some of those guys in that room were all younger than me, but we just have a lot of opportunity to build a relationship once we leave college, you know, and move on in our lives. So just really awesome experiences, both of those.
Yeah. I appreciate you sharing that. I mean, your passion comes out just talking about the, you know, what you've been able to orchestrate and put together. I mean, you put together the playing field and allowing these coaches to collaborate. I picture that in my head, right? Like all these coaches sitting around hour and a half after the conference is over. I mean, you know, I mean, how dedicated they are to, you know, being a coach. And I'm convinced about this. I think the coaching blood runs so deep that it wouldn't matter what sport they were in. I bet they could be coaching chess or tennis and they would still be as effective coaches as they were, because it's not about necessarily the sport. It's about the coaching, right? It's the navigating the relationships.
100%, 100%. I tell our guys, our coaches, but also our kids, like, it turns out in the history of the world, nothing great that stood the test of time was built on anything except for love. You know, the Catholic Church, regardless of one's opinion of it, was not built on hate. You know, schools where we send our kids, you know, in all of our communities, those were not built out of indifference. Everything that has stood the test of time was built in some way, shape, or form on love. And so championship football is the same thing. Championship anything is the same thing. It's built on love. And so in football, we talk about the sort of three pillars of that. You have to love to compete, you have to love your team, and you have to love yourself. And love to compete means you got to be willing to get out of bed and go do the hard work because you want that thrill of being able to be able to be seen and have people look at you and say, you are good enough, you are a champion, or you are not good enough, you came in eight out of eight, you know, teams. But it takes a vulnerability, and that requires a love of competition. And then love for your team. And even if it's like tennis and or golf, and you still have a team around you, coaches and sport, you have to understand that all of those people, when you are a champion, are all pulling in the same direction. You have to love and honor and respect all of what they are putting in to your success. And then ultimately, as you know, like, you got to love yourself. You got to, like, we are the most prominent, most consistent voice in our head. And if we are not positive, we cannot do positive things. So we have to be intentional about loving ourselves, just like we do with anybody else. And if we're not going to be successful. So I just think, like, a good coach comes from a place of love. And whether that's chess, to your point, or football, if you don't have that heart, you're not going to be as effective as you could be.
Which one of those three pillars do you think most coaches struggle with?
I mean, I think we all, whether you're a coach or not, I think we all struggle the most with being loving yourself, right? The idea that, I mean, particularly high achievers tend to focus on the 3% that I didn't get when I got the 97% score, or they focus on the one hit on the course where you tried to fade it and it turned out it just went straight. And so we focus on the negative for good reason. But what that means is we have to be intentional about the positive. And, you know, sometimes that's like, I mean, I will when I'm down, I live in Seattle, and so it's like gray in the winter, and that will impact, you know, my mental health sometimes. And so sometimes I'll just be like, I'll look in the mirror and say, man, look how good you look today. You know, just to tell myself something nice, because we all go through life. And like, when was the last time somebody came up to you and said, man, you look good. You look good today. In my life, that never happens. So I have to help build myself up. If I, and so coaches, if we are not being intentional about saying nice things to ourselves, we are only going to be saying, look at this shortcoming. Look at that shortfall. Look at how you didn't succeed here. And we're going to miss an opportunity to build ourselves up in the same way we want to try to build up the kids and people around us.
Yeah, well said. Well said. Coach, again, you had 15 different sites this year. You know, as an entrepreneur who, you know, you study relationships and obviously the logistics, can you just talk about the logistics of putting this in place all across the country? What were the biggest challenges that you had to overcome?
Yeah, it's been a heck of a ride. You know, first we had to, going back to March of last year, 2023, we started negotiating with hotels. And so we had to kind of take guesses on which hotels and which markets would be successful, and had to figure out models that would work, financial models for the would work for the hotel, would work for us. Then we had to build a team, a great team of folks who understood our vision, bought in. We have a team of six, and so we're small but mighty, and everyone had to understand kind of our why, and then they had to go kind of find good coaches that wanted to help kind of amplify the why and understood how it fit with their work. And so that took a lot of phone calls, a lot of conversations, a lot of email, a lot of Twitter DMs, like but soon that kind of generated its own kind of momentum where people would say, hey, great conversation. Here are three other dudes I think you should talk to because I know them and they would love this. And so pretty soon we were networking pretty widely, and people were coming to us. And then, you know, as we built the agenda, we had this kind of framework and a model and sort of secret sauce about how you kind of tee up some of these things, and finding the speakers was super hard. We had 55 speakers on average at every one of our clinics. That's a lot of speakers, dude. That's a lot of people to come and get lined up. And then the logistics of actually holding the thing, like we, you know, a lot of hotels, like you rent the AV and projectors and screens. And if we did that, we would not make it financially. So we bought all this gear. We rented vans and we drove three vans all around the country. So for instance, I said I was in Charlotte this last weekend. After our clinic, I drove that van to Indianapolis. I met Emily on our team. Actually, I met Emily, who was in Indianapolis. We met in Lexington, Kentucky. And then I transferred some gear to her van. I drove my van to Orlando. She drove her van to Minneapolis. We had another van that was going up and down the California coast. So, like, we're out on the road grinding. And I drove 16 hours one day. I got up at 4 o'clock in Charlotte and ended my day in Macon, Georgia, and went up to the Kentucky, Indiana, state line. So, that's just, but that's just hard work. That's just kind of, you know, just doing the thing that it takes. I'll add this. This is sort of parenthetically, but just there's this idea, the science of complexity, which maybe only three of your listeners will even care about. But there are things. There's chaos where nothing is related. There's simple or linear things where if A then B, if B then C, kind of stuff. There are complicated things which are just a bunch of if A then B things. And then there are complex things where there's multivariables and every variable influences each other. And we are not in that complexity place. It's just complicated. And so for things that are just complicated, all that means is you just got to take the time, you just got to do the work, and you just got to put the puzzle pieces on the table and put it all together. So it's been hard, but not impossible.
Yeah, no, love it, Coach. With that said, and I always talk with every one of our guests kind of about their hinge moments, right? That one moment, person, or event that connects who we are with, you know, who we eventually become. Sometimes we don't know these moments happen until weeks, months, years later, but tragedies obviously are immediate hinges because from that moment on, everything's different. But what's a hinge moment that you can share with our listeners?
You know, my top three hinge moments, the three most impactful things in my life are: one, marrying my wife, far and away the most important thing that I've ever done. And two, having my kids. We have three kids, and you know, gosh, I'm just super proud to be their dad. And
I love those hold kids. On a second. How did you and your wife meet?
We met at a bar. Like, it was, you know.
Okay. Why did you go to that bar that night?
Why did I go to that bar that night? So my friend had an emergency surgery and had to go into the hospital. And I was teaching community college in those days. And so his girlfriend at the time called and said, "Hey, there's this thing happening. Emergency surgery is going under general anesthesia. They're cutting him open. Can you come down and be here when he wakes up?" And I was like, absolutely. I ran down and spent the day there, kind of being with him, showing up and supporting him. And at the end of that day, I was like, man, I was with a friend. I was like, I can really, really use a drink right now. Why don't we go blow off a little steam and get a beer or something? And so we went up, and I was just looking like, you know, I had Stan Smith shoes on and wrinkled khaki pants and, you know, wrinkled polo. And I just was kind of a mess. But we showed up at this bar. And then my wife to be was there, and she had come in from work. So she was all dressed up, and I was like, "Hey, you know, do you want to dance?" And so we danced at this like little, you know, and neither of us were very good dancers. She was better than me, and then it just went from there. And I was so poor. I asked her out, like, you know, I lost her card. I asked her out 3 weeks later. And I was so poor. I was like, I can't, what am I, you know, I'll ask her for coffee. Cause you know, Seattle, go get coffee. She's like, "I don't like coffee." It's like, "Well, how about hot chocolate?" She's like, "Okay, hot chocolate." And so our first date, started with hot chocolate. And, so that,
awesome. That's like the hinge moment. Obviously there's layers to it, but your friend having surgery, if he doesn't have immediate surgery, you don't go to that bar that night.
Correct.
No, these, and so I always love to take that just a little bit different route, you know, but I appreciate you sharing that. What was the third one? What was the third hinge moment?
Going to Gonzaga University changed my life. And that's sort of an interesting story too. I grew up in Bend, Oregon, and I worked at a place called Jake's Truck Stop. I had a lot of jobs growing up, but I was working at this place called Jake's Truck Stop in high school. And, you know, truck stops are not for the glamorous, and this one was not either. And I asked the owner one day, I was like, "Hey, what do you know about this university in Spokane called Whitworth University?" I said, "Well, I don't know anything about Whitworth University, but I know the smartest guy I know went to Gonzaga. Would you like to talk to him?" I was like, "Yeah, sure." I was, I guess, 17 at the time. And so 4 or 5 hours later into my 8 hour workday, I was upstairs in the bathroom cleaning toilets at a truck stop. That's not, you know, something everybody gets the opportunity to do, nor would want to. And this guy shows up, and I'm in like in this stall cleaning stuff up. And he's like, "Hey, you know, is there a DJ in here?" And I said, "Yeah." He's like, "Okay, well, just take your time, come on out." And it's like, "Yeah, I'll be there in just a second." And so he came out, or I came out of the stall after I was done, and he's like, "Hey, you know, I hear you're interested in Gonzaga University." And so this guy was kind of a big shot in the oil and gas industry. And he stopped what he was doing and came and talked to me. And I was probably like the last kid in to Gonzaga. But they created room for me, and it was you know, he was very kind and helped say nice things about me. And so that cleaning stalls moment at Jake's Truck Stop got me connected to Gonzaga University, which then becomes one of my hinge moments.
I love it. I love it. Coach Gonzaga, right? Not Gonzaga.
That's right. That's right. G-O-N-Z-A-G-A. Go Gonzaga.
I'm going to make sure that is, that's clear for the listeners.
That's right. That's right.
You're not the first Gonzaga Gonzagian that we've had on the show, believe it or not, though. Sandy Zimmerman, who was also on American Ninja Warrior, she went to Gonzaga, played basketball there, believe it or not. So first mom to ever hit the buzzer on American Ninja Warrior.
Really?
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah, she's a fantastic lady, still lives there, and great Hinge moments, great person. She still lives there in Washington as well. So
that's great.
DJ, what question should I be asking that I haven't asked?
Oh, I don't know. How about you? I mean, tell me, give me the biggest dream, the biggest goal that you have, that you have not allowed yourself to believe you can achieve yet. The thing that you're like, boy, would it be so amazing if we could do that. But that's a little bit of a stretch. It'd be so amazing if we could do this, but all these other more manageable dreams, but the thing that'd be like, wow, this would be so super cool. And I actually might do it, but I'm not quite ready to commit yet. What is that for you?
Well, I still think it's, the biggest one is still having a major winner, you know, being able to being the mental coach for a major winner. I've had PGA Tour winners, but not a major winner yet. And the life of a sports psychology coach with professional athletes in particular, sometimes it's long, sometimes it's short. Just depends on the athlete mindset, where they are in their career. And I put yet in that because I know it will happen. I just don't know when. Mm-hmm. But that is where, you know, to win a major event, very few people do it. There's only 4 a year, obviously. It's happened with tennis on the doubles side, but it hasn't happened on the golf side. So that's the one that is still the North Star that is directing. And again, it'll happen. A lot of that is in God's hand, though, but I'm always doing the best job that I can with every athlete that I work with.
So I'm sure any of us who have competed at all know that only one really good team or one really good athlete ends the season with a win. Everybody else falls short. And you are probably a tremendous caregiver for all of your athletes. How do you think about your own self-care when you have poured yourself into a season or a tournament and the people that you care about that you're working with come up short? How do you then reflect back and say, okay, I have to actually heal a little bit myself here?
Yeah, the biggest thing that's helped with me, I mean, obviously, I think there are strategies with it, but it gets back to your identity and my identity. And it's not rooted in my performance. I mean, most of the life it has been, but it's rooted in God and what God says about me. It's the only way to be able to cope with the highest level of athletics and to come up short is to know that I'm not my performance. Because if I am my performance, then I'm only as good as my last performance. I'm only as good as what other people are going to say about me. And that road does not last. And it's a roller coaster of ups and downs. And even when you're the best, you're not the best for very long. And it's that's what it's always been rooted in, is my identity in God and Christ.
How do you think about transformation of your athletes? How do you think about transforming lives? Sometimes the ego that can be associated with competition and winning stands in conflict with our soul or spirit or message that we're carrying. How do you think about that?
So that one is depending on where the athlete is right then on their journey. So the earlier we can get them, I'd say we can get them, but the earlier that people are speaking truth into their life, the better path they're going to go on. What I mean by that is better people make better athletes. Better athletes do not make better people. So just because somebody is excellent in one skill set does not make them a great person. And I want to work with great people. You know, I want to work with people that And to basically answer that question, there has to be a why that is bigger than just holding up that trophy. I've worked with athletes whose why is to build tennis courts in underserved communities. You know, that runs deep, right? Because that's not about them. And so it's having them tap into what is a why that is greater than themselves. Because if it's greater than themselves, then it becomes the unity piece, and it becomes, you know, us, we. And I try to say this one a lot, but it's, you know, a better us makes a better you, and a better you is what makes a better us. So it's just about making the us larger and having that greater mission than just what the non-ambiguity of sport can provide.
And so what do you find your mission to be?
So, and I like the way that you flipped this, by the way, because we're still recording. But I don't get to talk a lot on my podcast, man. My North Star changes. So it has two things. One, I want people to recognize and seize that hinge moment that you don't know what it's going to look like or what it's going to be. But the other part is I want people to operate free of fear and anxiety. Want them to be, that's how I want to perform, free of anxiety and fear. And that is the ultimate goal.
I love that. I mean, I think that's, we have so many things pushing us towards fear or shame or the shadows. And there's nothing good. I mean, we're a little bit, most of us are a little bit past and removed pure survival modes. Where we need to worry about the lions on the savannah. Most of us, as you know, to your point, are holding ourselves back because we're living in fear or shame or guilt or something. And it's the most corrosive influence out there. So we got to overcome that. Mm-hmm. What counsel, what advice would you have for coaches of high school kids in terms of like trying to heal themselves, overcome some of that fear, guilt, shame, and then how to role model it so that these young people know they can see what overcoming looks like?
Yeah, it's multifaceted. One, I think of coaches that they can't do it all. So you have to bring in those that are around you, that network that is going to be around you, and then be able to equip these coaches to handle those sort of responsibilities. That's the importance, I think, of you know, mental coaching and sports psychology in general is being mm-hmm. that piece. The other is coaches' job is to create that environment where people feel loved, they feel worthy, not on what they do, but just who they are as an individual, you know. And if you pay attention, like, everybody has that something that they bring to the practice. It's not always going to be in the stat column or the box sheet, right? But yeah, they have that gift. And I think if we can create that and make sure people just understand that this skill that you have, like this gift, this sense of humor that you have, or this ability to look somebody in the eye, like, that's going to last way beyond when sport is over. And so when coaches create that environment, then what it also does, in my belief, is allow them to coach the athlete hard because they know that they're going to be loved and they know that they're trying to get the best out of them. Too often we miss that step and just coach them really hard, but then we miss the real growth, I think, that takes place. And so I think if athletes can understand that, look, they're loved and appreciated for more than what they do, performance wise, that that's just part of it. That's how they respond. And I hate the term buy-in. I don't use buy-in at all. I think it's allowing the athletes to take ownership of it. And when they take ownership of it, boom, now they're communicating better, right? Now they have a little bit more confidence. Now they're leading. And these are skills that last way beyond when sport's over. And that's what I think like the real goal of it is. And the higher that we get, the more that there just becomes more external influences in with that. But the fundamentals always stay the same. Fundamentals never change. Everyone's walking around with that special sign, that says, make me feel special. And And the more and more that coaches can do that, the better I think the athletes are going to become better people, and they're going to respond on and off the court or the field.
Want to listen to your favorite music, but you're sick of all the commercial interruptions and negative news today? Tune in to KukoRadio.com. Music for your mindset. We're a commercial-free online radio station playing nothing but hits. Our free iOS and Android apps are available for download at KukoRadio.com.
It's interesting, you know, I don't know anything about a lot of stuff, and one of the things I have no idea about is high-level golf and tennis, but I will say in the football world, particularly the college level right now, a lot of coaches are just very unhappy, miserable. Good example is a guy named Ryan Grubb, who was the offensive coordinator at the University of Washington, went to the University of Alabama with his head coach, Kalen DeBoer, and then opted to go to the NFL as the offensive coordinator for the Seattle Seahawks, all within a matter of a couple of months, because he said, like, the NFL is a better, healthier place than college football. And nobody would have said that even just a few years ago. But boy, college football now, like, I don't know anybody who, gosh, man, I guess maybe that's not quite right, but I don't know a lot of guys who are healthy and happy in college football coaching right now. It's such a grind. I think figuring out how to take care, it's very hard to take care of others if you can't take care of yourself. And I know in the football world, we're all a little bit kind of worried about what's happening in college football right now and how it's getting kind of deconstructed and the influence of money. Money's always been there, but it's just changing and different now.
Yeah. You know, I've said this to ADs years ago, I mean, early 2000s, I said, as long as football remains connected to the university and the university sports department, I said, it's not going to work, man, because we know the model's broken, but we don't know how to fix it. And let's just keep getting money and keep winning, right? When you have an entire conference that just dissolves in a matter of a weekend, I mean, just dissolves, man, it's gone. I mean, it shows you the fragility of the foundation that we're operating on. And so until you can remove football and it's separate, completely separate from the athletics department, it's just not going to work, because you have competing entities on both sides that are always going back to one another. And every time I mention it to the AD, they just kind of poo-poo it and say, yeah, that is never going to happen. You know what I mean? But I was like, okay, that's fine. But I mean, you have competing interests because it's such an entire business by itself. It will eventually turn there, but I think you need to have some figureheads that are going to take really the lead and make that happen. But again, yeah, that's my opinion, man. And it's just what I see, because I agree with you.
Yeah. And even guys like Chip Kelly, who was the head coach of University of California, Los Angeles, UCLA, opted out. Right. I mean, he's been an NFL guy. He's been a successful college coach, opted out of the head coaching profession so he could go be the OC at Ohio State. That says a lot, man, when you've got, and he was one of these figureheads, right? He came out and was advocating that we need to carve out into its own sort of league, college football, at least amongst Power Five. And people haven't, particularly outside of college sports, don't understand how this trickle-down effect will impact women's sports. It'll impact all other sports except for maybe college basketball, men's college basketball. But all other sports are at risk and in some peril because of funding, because of things like Title IX. Yeah. We're watching the deconstruction of college athletics as we know it right now.
Mm-hmm. And it is. I mean, it's totally separate. You cannot say the men's tennis team or women's rowing team is the same as a college high level program. Like, it's not even close to being on the same, but they share the same resources and are thrown into the same pot. So, hey man, I can go years on this, but then we get into sports sociology piece, you know, I love it, but DJ, man, I never really had it. I had a few times where people flipped the script on me, asked me questions, but these are really high intelligent people, so I can tell that is definitely one of you. I'll let you drop the mic. Just put the plug in, man, because you had a really successful 2024 with Playbook Clinics. Just where can people find more information about you and the clinics for 2025?
Yeah, I'd love to have them check us out at playbookclinics.com. We got a lot of great stuff, including videos of like some of our clinics and under our news tab there, sort of featuring some of the guys who are pouring their heart into young men and into these clinics. And our Twitter feed, just at Playbook Clinics, has a ton of stuff in terms of elevating voices from coaches across country who've been involved or maybe are just coming in and learning about us. So wherever we can shine a light on somebody doing great stuff, we want to do it. And thanks to you, Rob, for just continuing to do the same kind of thing, right? Putting a light on good stuff and casting a bunch of seeds and letting those grow into prosperity for folks. So thanks for doing what you're doing.
Awesome. Thanks, DJ.
Thanks for listening to Mental Toughness with Dr. Rob Bell. To find out more about Dr. Rob, visit his website at drrobbell.com or follow him on Twitter at Dr. Rob Bell. And subscribe to the show on your favorite podcast platform to get the next episode of Mental Toughness as soon as it's available. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.